This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. After another mass shooting at a concert, what can venues like Grossinger Motors Arena do to keep people safe?
It is one of the worst things that any venue manager can even imagine happening, and it would be the worst possible day for anybody that you know.
Bloomington's Arena Executive Director Lynn Cannon talks to GLT's Ryan Denham about thinking beyond metal detectors. You'll also hear from the general manager of the Bloomington Edge football team. He's traveling to Vegas for league meetings. His plane was landing as gunfire erupted. Get the ins and outs of sex offender and violent offender registration rules. And Tommy Castro is headed to the Castle Theater. GLT's John Norton catches up with the blues guitarist and singer, and you'll hear music from his new album, Stompin' Ground. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's October 3rd, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Authorities are working today to unravel the life of the 64-year-old gunman who fired on thousands of people attending a country music festival in Las Vegas, killing at least 59 people and injuring nearly 530. Stories are emerging from Vegas of concertgoers and tourists running for their lives. Charles Weldy from Bloomington Normal was there, too. He's the general manager of the Bloomington Edge indoor football team, and he was traveling to Vegas, the city where he once lived, for league meetings. He tells GLT's Ryan Denham that his plane was landing Sunday just as the gunfire began at nearby Mandalay Bay.
When we landed, you know, right when you land, everyone turns their phones on. The lady that was sitting right behind me was also from Vegas. She was at a Cubs game and was just flying back to Vegas. And she turned her phone on and had a bunch of missed calls and missed text messages from her husband because there's something going on. And so she called him. And he was on the police scanner, and they were kind of relaying the information to us as it was happening. So they were talking about there's a shooter. They didn't really know exactly what was going on, and it just kind of spread through the plane, you know, and there's some very horrified looks. And at that time, not much information was out, and not much correct information was out. So what was really interesting was how many different stories you heard just from the time I got off the plane to the parking garage, about different numbers of shooters and different numbers of casualties and different numbers of locations. As it turns out, they shut down quite a few casinos right as that was happening because there were other stories about, oh, there's a shooter over at this hotel, there's a shooter at that hotel. So it was pretty chaotic, as you can imagine, and not just at the location, but at quite a few properties up and down the strip.
So what happens next?
Well, so I got out. When I was at the parking garage, the airport is less than a mile from Mandalay Bay. So, you know, you're standing there and you're hearing it on police radio and things like that. And it's pretty early because the cops are just now starting to arrive. So this is all happening. And it's very surreal when you're standing. You know, I couldn't hear gunfire or anything, but I can see the property. So it took us a little over an hour to get to our hotel. And then when we got to Harrah's, which is where we're staying, they had locked all the doors. So they have they're right on the strip, and all the doors that were on the strip, they had chained shut. So these big metal chains, they're all padlocked on all the doors. And they were, you know, security, we had to go through two security checkpoints to get into the parking garage to get dropped off. Go inside the casino to check in. Everything's closed down. There's no, all the table games are closed. You know, all the restaurants are closed. And they're going, the security personnel is there. They're going to every person. Okay, you're staying here. Okay, go up to your room. If not, they walk you out. So, you know, it's a unique situation in Vegas because very few people have cars. You know, everyone's traveling and they get here and you don't need a car. So if you're at one of these properties that's shut down, you know, where do you go?
Yeah. Did you see any victims who were maybe walking down away from that side of the strip, maybe up the strip toward MGM, New York, and toward you at Harrah's?
When I got to Harrah's, they didn't want us leaving if we stayed there. So I wasn't actually allowed to get outside of the hotel. We were pretty much on lockdown. So I didn't see anything firsthand, but there was a lot of people coming in from there that were talking about being there. If you're in Mandalay Bay when it happened, you don't know what's going on. You know, if you're, let's say, you're at the concert and you're staying at Mandalay Bay, and all this happens, well, you're running to try to get back to your hotel. Well, they had shut that hotel down too. So you got people trying to run out of Mandalay Bay, people trying to run into Mandalay Bay. And then Harrah's got cleared out. So people, at one point, right before I got there, they had chased everybody out. And you heard stories of police and SWAT teams running through these casinos with automatic weapons and their riot gear. And tensions were definitely high. People were, as you can imagine, extremely on edge and shocked. Everything was locked down that night. Of course, I was watching the news and trying to text friends that I know that live out here and just make sure everyone was safe. The next morning, around 7:30, it seemed like people were getting back into their hotel at Mandalay Bay. They set up some places for them to go. I was out on the street about 7:30 a.m., just kind of walking on Las Vegas Boulevard. The south end of the street was still closed, where Mandalay Bay and Luxor and those things are. And there was police everywhere. There was a couple police or security in front of every property. There were two at each door, at each entry door, you know, so there was no doubt of police force. In fact, there still was last night as we were, you know, another day passed, as we went out to dinner, whatever. There's everywhere you go, there's cops, there's cop cars, lights are on, just kind of sitting at different properties. There was a definite high alert situation.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm speaking with Charles Weldy, the general manager of the Bloomington Edge football team. He was in Las Vegas yesterday as the shooting unfolded at Mandalay Bay. Was there any semblance of normal activity later in the day on Monday? Did people start gambling again? Were the lights turned back on? Did things ever return to normal yesterday or even this morning?
You know, they absolutely did. You know, it was 24 hours later. So yesterday afternoon, we had a lunch break where we're from our conferences, and I was walking out to get some food, and everyone was back, man. Everyone was playing. Everyone was walking around. Of course, it was a little more somber than usual. And most conversations centered around, hey, where were you when it happened? Were you okay? Did you get out? What was it like if you were there? But everyone was right back to it. You know, I thought that was really resilient of the city, you know. And, yeah, definitely people are upset, of course, and somber. And you have a lot of lives that have been affected. But I think people wanted to just keep living their lives. So it was really neat to see people just back out. And, you know, maybe it's because it's a heavy tourist. Well, I think maybe it's just because it's a busy type of city anyway. People like to go out and do things here, and they were, you know, they were out and about. They were still remembering and talking, but they were busy. It was nice.
Well, what about your league meetings? Did the league consider postponing or canceling? How did that kind of unfold, and how did you guys acknowledge what had happened and still kind of get the job done, get the business done?
Everyone came in on Saturday, so everyone was kind of here. I was late coming in because I had some other stuff to do with the Edge over the weekend, so I didn't get in till late Sunday night. So we sent kind of an email out to make sure everyone was safe and everyone was here, and then we decided just to go forward with it. Of course, it was a talking point, you know, everyone kind of talked about it and things like that, but we felt safe. You know, there's a really good security presence, and no one was really nervous about it, and we wanted to just keep, like we said, wanted to just keep moving forward and be respectful of those that were involved, but at the same time, you know, you have to keep moving forward.
All right, Charles. Well, did you see anything else or have any of your observations from your time there over the last 36 hours that you want to mention?
I think a lot of fears now are that maybe a blueprint has been created for a mass casualty event. A lot of people I talk to that do live here, you know, taxi drivers, dealers, casino dealers, things like that, are saying they're surprised it hasn't happened sooner. So I think people are a little bit worried that maybe, you know, hey, here's how you can do something like this if you want to. So interested to see how, you know, the next steps the city. I know the response was phenomenal, you know, and the security presence has been phenomenal. So they've done a great job.
Charles Weldy is the general manager of the Bloomington Edge football team, speaking with GLT's Ryan Denham from Las Vegas. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. For mass shooters and suicide bombers looking for a soft target like concerts, the one on Sunday night in Vegas, they're an easy target. The Vegas shooting comes in the heels of the Manchester bombing after an Ariana Grande concert killing 23 people. 2 years before that, it was the Eagles of Death Metal concert in Paris. Is there anything concert venues can do to keep people safe? GLT's Ryan Denham spoke with Lynn Cannon, the executive director of Bloomington's Grossinger Motors Arena.
Today is an awful day. It is one of the worst things that any venue manager can even imagine happening, and it would be the worst possible day for anybody that you know. I mean, the first thing you think of is immediately, are any of my family or friends in Vegas this weekend? And who might I know that may have worked this show? Because we all know each other. We're all so close, and it's such a horrible thing to have happen.
What are some things that VenueWorks does to keep concertgoers safe these days?
So VenueWorks and Grossinger Motors Arena, we employ all kinds of safety measures. Starting with when you walk through the doors, we have magnetometers similar to what you would see at the airport, where you walk through an open doorway that would signal us if any kind of metal objects were in anyone's pockets. We ask everyone to open up any bags or purses that they are carrying, and our security staff takes a look inside, making sure that they, you know, see all the way to the bottom and that they pass that along outside the metal detector so the person walking through has none of that on their person when they're walking through. So keys, cell phones, anything that would normally set off a metal detector would be outside of that person's body when they walk through, and then we have a chance to take a look at it. And then we do that for all of our events.
Mass gatherings, I think, are considered kind of very soft target when it comes to attacks like this. Is there more that we could be doing on the security front when it comes to mass gatherings like this, or is it maybe an issue that maybe the solution to lies somewhere else?
You know, I think it's all of our responsibilities to remain safe, whether you're a concert goer or a venue, you know, employee. Keep your eyes and ears open. If you see something that doesn't look right or you hear somebody saying something that doesn't sound right, then report it and let us know so that we can take the steps that we know how to take to make sure that we employ those safety measures that we have available to us, including and up to, you know, informing the police department and fire department if necessary.
So obviously the shooter in this case was not attending the concert. This gentleman was in the hotel kind of looking down on the concert. But what do you think of this notion of potentially adding new security requirements to the actual ticketing process itself, where the tickets to concerts and events like this become more like airline tickets, where they're not like transferable and you can't like hand them to somebody on the street and then that person goes to the concert? What do you think of that? Have you heard of that? And what would be your reaction to something like that?
I think in the long run, anything that keeps us as safe as possible is the right thing to do. Logistically, being able to, you know, screen everybody in that manner when you're putting 40,000 people into a venue for a show that's going to start in 1 hour may not be realistically possible. So it becomes a matter of, you know, how much can you do and what is the right thing to do. If it were me, and I think that this is, you know, the way of the future, that there will be more security measures in place everywhere I go, I would feel better about it, and I would be willing to get there earlier and spend more time going through security than not.
Are you worried at all that an episode like this might scare people away from attending large concerts, at least temporarily?
I hope not. I think that, you know, knowing that we are taking very serious security measures here at the arena, and knowing that, you know, we spend a great deal of time training our staff to look for and to watch for any kinds of items that may not be permitted. We have evacuation procedures in place for any kind of event, whether it be, you know, a fire emergency or any kind of, issue where we have any kind of smoke in the building, to the fact that we have severe weather measures where we're not letting anybody outside the building, you know, due to a severe weather situation. So I think, you know, one of the things that I can, you know, see is that we are one of the safest places to be during an event where the, you know, incident in Las Vegas took place. That person never had to go through those security measures. And unfortunately, you know, you see that more often than not.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm speaking with Lynn Cannon, the executive director of Grossinger Motors Arena in downtown Bloomington. That's the former U.S. Cellular Coliseum. We're going to pivot now and talk about a proposal to have VenueWorks, the company that is managing Grossinger Motors Arena, also take over management duties at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts, just north in downtown Bloomington. So, Lynn, why is this a good deal for the city of Bloomington taxpayers, and why is it a good deal for VenueWorks?
So I think the best thing is that the opportunity for VenueWorks to expand their opportunity in the city of Bloomington, to make more people feel like they have an opportunity to see more events in the city and to bring more events to the city for the community. We have a great staff here at the arena that has already been working very closely with the staff at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts, as we've looked at ways that we can book some shows over there before this management proposal even came to be. So I think for all of us, you know, we're both city-owned venues. We both both operate similar types of facilities, so the synergy is there. We have employees in both places that do similar jobs. So as we're looking to transform from one arena here to this plus the BCPA, there's an opportunity to expand people's positions and give them more responsibility. So I think this is a great opportunity for us internally as well as to the community at large.
Can you talk a little bit more about what would happen to the staff at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts, those who are already there, mm-hmm. and then talk about some of the efficiencies that I know you hope to find. I think the city said that you'd be looking to reduce total personnel costs for the city BCPA by about $200,000 annually.
So there are positions that are currently open, both at the arena and at the BCPA, and in making this proposal, we've specifically been slowing down the hiring process in both places to try to see where we can make cost-efficient savings there, where we can have one person fill a job that may be able to be done in both buildings. Not every event is going to be able to, afford that possibility. If we have a sold-out concert here at the arena and they've got a sold-out show at the BCPA, we may have to bring in some of our other VenueWorks employees, which is one of the great benefits of being with VenueWorks, is that we have venues throughout the Midwest where we can count on them to come in and give us a hand when we reach the capacity of both buildings where we're very stressed. But I think that in the end, having the full-time employees join the VenueWorks team, and that's the transition plan includes all of the full-time positions at the BCPA transitioning to VenueWorks employees, and that would be up to each individual employee to make that decision on their own.
My understanding is that VenueWorks would be paid about $36,000 a year per this contract if Bloomington Aldermen go along with this plan. Are there other fees or other commissions that would also potentially be paid to VenueWorks as it operates the BCPA?
This contract has not been definitive yet, so there isn't any real answers that I can give you at this time. But, I mean, we are very open to whatever the city is looking for as far as what they would like us to perform in what capacity for the BCPA.
And what will be the length of this agreement?
It is my understanding that it would match the current arena contract so that it would mirror exactly the length of the term with the Grossinger Motors Arena.
It sounds like that would be, there's about 4 years?
A little less than four years. We've been here a little over a year already.
What about booking of acts? What kind of efficiencies could you find there in terms of coordinating between the two buildings to find, find ways to bring interesting acts here and find efficiencies with scheduling those two in both buildings?
So we have already been working in conjunction with each other to make sure we don't book the same type of act at the same time, since that would only be detrimental to both of us. But in booking with, in contracting with VenueWorks, one of the advantages is that we would be able to route shows between VenueWorks buildings throughout the Midwest. And we have several venues of similar size to the BCPA where we would be able to book a contract with an act where they would do four or five of our venues in one fell swoop. They would go from one end of the Midwest to the other and work all the VenueWorks buildings in between.
Well, that's Lynn Cannon, the executive director of Grossinger Motors Arena in downtown Bloomington. And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham.
VenueWorks has managed the former Coliseum since April of 2016 when it took over for Central Illinois Arena Management. That company's owner now faces fraud charges related to the arena. The Bloomington City Council will hear about a plan to put VenueWorks in charge at the BCPA during a work session October 9th. A final vote could come 2 weeks later. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Soderstrom Skin Institute. Founded in 1973, their team of board-certified dermatologists treat acne, psoriasis, eczema, skin cancer, and all diseases of the skin. Soderstrom Skin Institute has immediate openings for dermatology appointments at 2100 Jacobson Drive, Normal. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Coming up, it's music from and conversation with Tommy Castro. He'll play tunes from his new album, Stompin' Ground, at the Castle Theater on Thursday. The interview is still to come during Sound Ideas on GLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner displeased a substantial portion of his own party last week by signing a law that allows taxpayer funding for Medicaid abortions and state employee health insurance. That's the subject of this week's Politics Roundtable. IPR Sean Crawford moderates the panel this week, composed of public television reporter Amanda Vinicky, IPR's Daisy Contreras, and Kent Redfield of the University of Illinois at Springfield. Contreras says the measures also eliminated trigger language, which would have made abortions illegal if Roe v. Wade is overturned at the federal level, and that reverses the governor's earlier statements.
So now in April, the governor stated intentions that he would veto the bill, which riled up pro-choice advocates. And Governor Rauner ran as a pro-choice candidate, and those pro-choice advocates were sure to remind him of that every chance they could.
Amanda, you were there for the governor's signing and the announcement of this, at least. And it sounded as though he had a tough time with this decision. He spoke rather softly, very measured in his speech. What was your takeaway from it?
Yeah, it was certainly a very different tone. Typically at bill signings, he's more jovial, particularly when surrounded by advocates, which he was. There were a lot of women. Corinne Wood, a familiar name to those who follow Illinois politics, former lieutenant governor, was one of them who spoke at the its event. But it was not a bill signing ceremony. You know, typically he gives away pens and, again, is happy. You're there for supporters, with supporters. But that was very much not the case. Don't know what to make of that tone. We tried asking about it, and the governor continued to get back to just the serious nature of the discussion, saying that he does understand and knows that there are irrefutable moral and religious aspects that need to be considered. But I don't know if that was why he took such a serious and almost morose tone, or if it was that he knew what he was stepping into of the political consequences of a decision like this.
Well, we heard from those folks who were upset by this, and that included Peter Breen, mentioning that the governor might have some type of primary challenge from somebody on the right. And what are we hearing about that? Are we hearing any names that are really floating that could potentially challenge Governor Rauner?
The only name that is out there thus far really is Sam McCann, the state senator, who, of course, has had public feuds with Governor Rauner following his vote on a measure that unions saw as detrimental to them, and Rauner really had wanted passed, and instead McCann kind of broke ranks and was the first one to do so in a pretty spectacular fashion publicly, and to say no and stick with Democrats on that one instead. And so McCann is the only name that is out there. He, of course, has, I think, some issues, though, when it comes to ethics measures or campaign spending. But that's not to say that that's the only person. We tried asking Representative Breen multiple times, you know, who are you going to get? And who could go up against Governor Bruce Rauner's money, given that Rauner has become the primary funder, really, of the Illinois Republican Party and races such as Breen's own?
And Kent Redfield?
Well, and, you know, I think, yes, you can put somebody on the ballot. I don't think that you're going to beat an incumbent governor in a Republican primary, because that's certainly not, you know, abortion is an issue. It's not the only issue. The real danger from a primary is that if you heard these voices yesterday, you know, Representative Senator McSweeney was talking about a failed governor. Breen was talking about an inability to competently administer the state and stand up to Madigan. And so, you know, a primary opponent to the governor is going to get a lot of media attention. And if you're going to hear a lot about not just the abortion, but you're going to hear about the governor can't deliver, the governor's incompetent. And that's, you know, that's the narrative the Democrats want to carry on into the primary, is that, you know, whatever you like about what Governor Rauner said before he got elected, you know, he can't deliver. He's, you know, he's a failure, and he's made things worse. And so the real damage from the primary is that negative narrative, and then it adds to, you know, what it could really be an intensity gap. It's not that people won't show up and vote for Rauner in the general election. It's just they're not going to be, particularly in his right, the base, the social conservatives, they're not enthusiastic. They're not going to go bring their friends. And so, you know, a primary, you know, would be, you know, would have a lot of negative impacts. This is going to have negative impacts on his base in terms of enthusiasm to begin with, but a primary would just really intensify that, because whoever's running against him is going to get a lot of free media coverage. They don't, you know, they don't need to run a lot of ads, because it's going to be point counterpoint with the governor.
And Daisy, the governor, you know, going back to when he ran the first time, And he pointed this out in his comments on Thursday of this week, talking about this bill. He says he's always been pro-choice.
Yeah, he said he wasn't walking away from his initial remarks on where he stood personally. And ultimately, according to him, his decision to sign this measure boiled down to giving women access to abortions regardless of their income, and that him and his, you know, his wife were always going to stand behind that.
The issue with this, and this brings up something else that could damage the governor in a primary, is that there is, and damages him, frankly, from a governmental standpoint from here on out, although it's already perhaps been a drag already, is that he has now is perceived as a liar, that there is a trust issue. While the governor said, I have always been pro-choice and am never going to change my mind, he, in fact, apparently did, because he stated to Republican legislators and his administration issued a statement, and then the governor went on programs. I know during an interview it came up with me talking about his intention to veto the measure, that this abortion bill, House Bill 40, that we're talking about.
Amanda Vinicky is a public television correspondent. Kent Redfield is a retired professor at the University of Illinois at Springfield. Joining them on the Illinois Politics Roundtable were IPR's Daisy Contreras and moderator Sean Crawford. You're listening to Sound Ideas. Mike McCurdy. The Bloomington Police Department is tracking about 200 Bloomington residents as part of two state-mandated offender registers. Bloomington Police Officer Sean Albert serves as the Bloomington Police Department's sex offender compliance officer, assigned to the neighborhood focus team. One of his duties is conducting sex offender compliance checks. He's also in charge of the two state-mandated registers. One registration is for those convicted of sex crimes. The other falls under the murderer and violent offenders against youth registration. GLT's John Norton talked with Officer Albert about the details of the registrations.
The purpose of the registration list is to, A, give information to law enforcement about where these individuals are, and B, also in the case of the sex offenders, provide information to the public as to where these individuals may be.
So is there a distinction between, say, the violent offender and the sex as to who can see the list?
There are differences in who can see the list and the fact that, take for example, the violent offender murder registration is out there for the public to see, just as it is for the sex offender. But in the case where, say, a juvenile offender, for example, is adjudicated as a juvenile in juvenile court for these crimes, that list is not generally available to the public. It is available to law enforcement, and under certain other instances, we are mandated to provide it to individuals in the community, but is not published on the website for people at large to see.
If a 14 or 15-year-old is convicted as an adult for one of these crimes, are they automatically on the list?
If they are 14 or 15 years old and they take an adult conviction, they will be found on as an adult offender. Whenever you take an adult conviction versus a juvenile adjudication, you take the consequences of an adult conviction.
So it's the conviction itself, not the age.
Yes.
That's considered. What is the relation between a registration and restrictions on these people?
The restriction laws are separate from registration.
Okay.
The registration simply means they have to come and report the required items in the manner and time frame required of them. And the restrictions that most people think of, such as, say, a child sex offender entering upon a park property, residing next to a school, those are completely separate laws.
So you are required to register every so often for these lists?
Yes.
And what happens if you don't?
If you don't, you could face criminal consequences in both state or federal court in the case of a sex offender crime.
Off the top of your head, do you know what those consequences are?
All of them are felony crimes.
So that's serious. How often do you need to register or re-register?
At a minimum, once annually, based upon conviction. Some individuals, based upon their conviction, are required at a minimum every 90 days. And they must come in and update at other times as required. For example, if they were to update their employment, change where they were living, or some other reporting requirement had changed, they're required within 3 days of the change to come and report that as outlined under the Act.
What's the distinction of someone who asks to register every 90 days compared to yearly?
People who register for 90 days typically have an aggravated crime as the conviction, and or they've received a conviction for violation of the sex offender registration in the past.
Okay, so if you're on the murderers and violent offenders against youth registration, you've been convicted of murder, not manslaughter?
Murder. You've been convicted of murder, or and in the case where other crimes against children, typically like a heinous battery against a child or child abduction, you'll find those individuals.
Have you seen instances of people who are being charged with murder, with being charged with some serious crimes, that actually plead to lesser charges because they won't be on the registration list?
I don't keep track of the court documents, but I'm sure that that does happen, and that might be a motivator to plead to a lesser crime.
Okay. I wanted to talk definitions. We've talked about murder. Who is considered a violent offender?
A violent offender is those individuals outlined by the Act who've committed a qualifying crime against a child. People who've an aggravated battery against a child. Someone who's, for example, also like a shaken baby death would be included in there. Unlawful restraint, kidnapping, abducting, luring of children would be those individuals that would find themselves in.
And this is against children only. Someone who would do this against an adult, they would not be included?
They would not be included as a violent offender against children. Now, if they've murdered an adult, they would be on the murder portion of the registry. But the violent offenders against youth portion of it applies towards acts against children.
A sex offender, by definition, is a violent person. Can they be on both lists?
Technically, they commit crimes which would qualify them to be on both lists. Due to data entry constraints, and what happens is the law enforcement database can only enter them as one, in which case, if they've committed a sex crime, they will default to the sex offender list, and their other acts will be listed as a portion of the registration, but they will be primarily listed as a sex offender.
Does that present any problems to not be on a number of lists if it qualifies?
It actually makes it easier. It makes it easier for the offender, makes it easier for us in law enforcement, because then the person's reporting only under one calendar versus if he was having to register under multiple lists, he could be in there all the time at different dates, and it cuts the number of times down that we have to do the entries with the people. It also makes it clear that the offender has one date to show up versus multiple.
We're talking with Bloomington Police Officer Sean Albert. This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. We're talking about the different registration lists that he tracks, that he's in charge of for the Bloomington Police Department. Well, let's get to the number. 200, roughly, on average, are on the list. Is that a high number?
For a city our size, that's relatively high when you look at per capita for the size town we are around the state. We have a large number of sex offenders when, roughly other towns who you may say Bloomington normal may be comparative to Springfield, but we're talking just Bloomington here. Okay.
So why is it high compared to other cities, if best you can tell?
From what I've gathered dealing with and working with the sex offenders in town, there are services here in town available to them that may not be available in other communities.
There's some good mental health services here?
Mental health services that accept them. There are some mental health programs around the state which will not accept them by default because they are sex offenders, whereas we have a local treatment provider who will. We have a sex offender treatment program which isn't available in all parts of the state, and many individuals who receive convictions from the court are required by the court to obtain treatment, which may bring somebody into the area. And we have jobs available for these individuals. We have a vast majority of the people registering me are working someplace.
How difficult is it to keep people registering and re-registering? What are the incentives that you use to make sure that they stay on track?
Well, my goal for them is I sit down with each one of these individuals, educate them on what they should and shouldn't do and how they need to get themselves registered. We make a registration available to our police department 24/7. Our typical business hours for registration is Monday through Friday from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. at night. But if there is an emergency something comes up, we make there's a standing order and process by which these folks can always get registered. So they know that right off the bat, which makes it available to them to actually do this. We let people know there's no punishment for coming in early because all the registration forms state that you are to register on or before a certain date. So if it didn't work out for their schedule and they couldn't be here on the 5th and they were due on the 5th, they could come in the 2nd or the 3rd or the 4th or any time before that date and get themselves registered. So we try to make ourselves available to them so that they have the ability to do it without any issues. And two, I've tried to relay to them that this is something they're going to have to do. If they show up late and they go non-compliant and it's out on the website, somebody is going to call and complain. It's not if, it's just when. And if they don't do it for anybody else, if they do it for themselves. Because if they keep themselves compliant, it's better for them.
How long do you stay on the list? Forever?
You stay on the list based upon your conviction. Juvenile offenders have the ability to be petitioned to be removed from the list, provided that they serve a certain number of years and have no problems. The other individuals are based upon conviction. So if you have a conviction, that's, it's all conviction-based. So if you have an aggravated conviction, it may require you to register for life. If you have a minor conviction, such as a misdemeanor, crim sex abuse, it's a 10-year registration, provided that you don't find yourself in any more trouble.
There's a distinction that I don't know if it has more to do with restrictions than the registration itself, but on the sex offender, a child sex offender, I'm guessing, has a higher recidivism rate than maybe a sex offender in general, or maybe even someone convicted of murder. Do you treat those differently?
What I do is I interview all these folks. Everybody's given a fair chance. I hope that they would take that chance and move on with their life. However, my job to be a policeman is to also look for indicators that there might be a problem. And when you think about the registration as a whole, if you're coming in and doing everything you're supposed to and reporting like you're supposed to, and there's not any complaints, there may or may not be a problem. The issue comes in like when people start lying about their behavior. That may be an indicator of a problem, because especially if you were lying about your behavior to the police in a criminal matter, that's the chance that they may be some recidivism in the criminal aspect in some aspect, whether that be minor or major, working their way up to a major crime. But since we've been more proactive in monitoring these folks, there's not a year gone by that we haven't found an individual with a new child victim.
How has this list or these lists helped Bloomington Police, and especially you, do your job better?
Well, as the list has become more available to the public, because we're much more connected than we were in years past, it allows us to have not just the police department looking for the welfare of the community, but the community as a whole have that information at their fingertips, and allows us to gather and gain information faster than we would have in times past, or if at all, in some instances. Because
I realize you're just following state law when you do something like this. One of the problems I could see with this list is someone who committed a crime decades ago and is maybe still on a list. Maybe they've rehabilitated themselves. Do you hear from that at all?
I have complaints from offenders who say, listen, I haven't done anything in so long. But, you know, in life, if we make poor decisions, sometimes we have a poor outcome.
Bloomington Police Officer Sean Albert is with us on GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. This is your baby within the Bloomington Police Department, right?
Yep. This is my full-time assignment.
Is this something you readily took on, something you sought out, something you were assigned and kind of grew into?
Years ago, I was the neighborhood office for the West Side, and what I started seeing is I was dealing with a lot of gang and drug problems, but in dealing with community problems, I noticed we had officers assigned to do active sex crimes, but we did not have officers at that time adequately assigned to follow up after the sex crime was convicted for the individuals who were back in the community. We have officers assigned to work gang and drug units, but no one was assigned to work sex crimes like this, though I was getting the complaints from the neighborhood associations. I was running into these problems in the neighborhood. So I started taking that on, and at the chief at the time decided that it was working in the neighborhood, and we were having results, and it needed to be done. In addition to that, there are mandates that we should be going out and doing these things.
What are some of those results?
We've found child sex offenders committing new crimes in the neighborhood. Not calls from victims saying, please, please come help me, but things we've discovered through the course of doing checks or being active in the community and then having the community work with us, which we weren't doing in the past, but we've found individuals who are volunteering as youth sports officials. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have found people volunteering and working, doing daycare as a child sex offender. We found them with new victims when we've shown up for checks. We've found individuals committing other crimes in the community because, you know, just because somebody did a sex crime doesn't necessarily mean they're relegated to only committing one type of crime. And we've found people as working as volunteers in youth groups, you know, Boy Scouts, for example. Every year we've found victims new sex crime victims that weren't calling for help. We found them as the result of going out in the community and checking. And then those checks have resulted in new cases.
Bloomington Police Officer Sean Albert speaking with GLT's John Norton about the various registrations required of those convicted of a sex offense, as well as those convicted of murder or a violent offense against a youth. Offenders must also pay a $100 registration fee when re-registering annually. Albert says the fee is waived for those who are homeless or indigent. It's Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Understanding a changing world takes a little time.
Philando Castile's uncle, Clarence Castile, also spoke at the rally.
Numbers from the federal government today provide more detail about the extent of the nation's opioid crisis.
They have now prevailed on the core issue of Trump's agenda, trade, immigration, and now climate change.
Take some time to keep the news coming. Find 2 minutes now for us and become a sustaining member. Thanks.
Your support keeps us going, so contribute anytime at WGLT.org.
It's the GLT Fund Drive. How much should you contribute to help pay for GLT and NPR programs you depend on? Well, that's entirely up to you. You know how much you value GLT, and you know how much you can afford to give. You can give as little or give a lot. Whatever works for you works for GLT. Give online now at WGLT.org. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy, and this is Tommy Castro. Blues All Around Me from Stompin' Ground, the new release from Bay Area bluesman Tommy Castro. When Castro makes his annual return to the Castle Theater in Bloomington Thursday night, he'll feature songs from this new album. He tells GLT's John Norton that the songs are a mishmash of the sounds he heard growing up in San Jose, California, in the late 1960s and early 1970s.
When I was a kid, there was a pretty diverse group of kids that we hung out with in my neighborhood and growing up in San Jose, California. I was starting to fool around with the guitar, and I was listening to rock and roll music on the radio, and me and a lot of my friends had discovered blues. You know, we were a bunch of hippie kids playing rock and roll and blues, and when, you know, you'd walk down the streets in the neighborhood, there would be guys in lowrider cars driving by, and they were always blasting soul music. They would always be blasting, James Brown or Wilson Pickett or Junior Walker and the All-Stars. I remember hearing Shotgun was one of the favorites. So I got exposed to soul music that way, and I'd already been, you know, listening to rock and roll and blues with my other friends. And as time went on, some of the music that was coming out was appealing to everybody. And so the cats that were driving around town in the lowrider cars, the Mexican-American kids, they were starting to play songs by War and Santana and Tower of Power. And there was a place where, all the hippie kids and the lowrider dudes, we kind of like all started going to the same parties and hanging out at the same music events. And it was a really great time because, the music started to just be so inclusive. All of these different sounds, were happening, and that's the kind of stuff that inspired me to do what I do. And if you listen to my music and everything from my first record I ever made on, it's a combination of soul music, blues, and rock and roll. Come home at night, I see my woman, it's right there on her face. Something I did or didn't do, I better duck just in case. I said the blues is all around me, crushing on my brain.
Joe Louis Walker and I have had this conversation. Sounds like you and he musically came of age around the same time and around the same place. I think he was in San Francisco. But, you know, we have talked about how the Fillmore West and the venues are in, you know, in the Bay Area, you know, would have jazz and blues and rock and soul and everybody on the same bill at the same time.
Yeah.
Everyone seemed to be trying to mash all of this music together just to see what they can make out of it. Was that kind of what was going through you at the time as well?
Oh, we just didn't think about it much, you know. We weren't trying to figure it out. We didn't realize it, but we were in one of the great times in musical history. And one great record after another was coming out, you know, and you would hear it. You'd hear them on the radio, usually listening to FM radio in those time, at that time. FM was still a fairly new format, right? And they were free to play anything they wanted, and you would hear long version of Blues Power by Albert King on the radio. That's just something you're not going to hear.
Right.
I remember the term underground radio being used, you know, but FM was still kind of new. And there weren't as many sponsors and commercials. And so the DJs, just whatever they found that they liked, they would put it on the radio. And first time I heard Taj Mahal was Bacon Fat. Was being played on a regular basis on one of the stations I listened to. And that's another really long track. I would never dream of playing it nowadays on mainstream rock and roll station, which eventually, you know, that's what all those stations became, like KSAN and KSJO in my hometown of San Jose. And it was an interesting time. Definitely, I was lucky to grow up in that time period. And you know, the record also talks about life the way it was in those days. It was, I think, the song My Old Neighborhood, you know, talks a little bit about what things were like back then. A lot felt a lot simpler.
The air was cold. Rain clouds are forming. See men with lunch pails and coffee. Start their steel trucks and cars. They had good union jobs. They drank and worked in man's bars.
My Old Neighborhood is the name of the song you're hearing from Tommy Castro's brand new release called Stomping Ground. And I want to ask you about one other song on the album that's interesting for the song choice and for who's helping out on you. And that's the 10th song on the album. It's, you're covering Buddy Miles' song, Them Changes. And David Hidalgo of Los Lobos plays and sings on this one. And, you know, Tommy, in the liner notes, you said that for all, I think you said it this way, all your guests on this album, you knew as you were assembling and writing these songs, who you wanted to play or sing on these albums. So with Hidalgo, what was the choice there?
Well, David and I have been friends for a while. You know, we run into each other at once or twice a year, but usually on the legendary Rhythm and Blues Cruise, the original Blues Cruise, which I am fortunate enough to be able to go on every time it sails. I host something called the Legendary Rhythm and Blues Review. And so me and my band get to go on every blues cruise that sails. It's been that way for the last 25 cruises or so. And the Legendary goes out twice a year. And so I've made a lot of friends with some of my favorite artists, you know, and I'm a big fan of Los Lobos. So, you know, jamming with those guys once in a while and, you know, having backstage conversations and so on, you know, the idea came up, you know, that maybe we would do something together sometime. So I got a hold of David and asked him if he would play on the album because I felt this was a really good fit for him and I. You know, it's a song from those days, you know, that was really popular in those days. And it was one of those songs that all the bands, everybody played. If you had a party and there was a band playing, they always played Them Changes. And that went on for years.
Well, my mind is going through them changes. Feel like committing a crime.
And then finally, you know, people stopped playing it. And it has been a long time since I heard anybody, you know, jam into that song. I thought it'd be a good time to bring it back.
Yeah.
And it was so much fun, man. I mean, God, he's such a great voice, and what a great player, you know. Yeah, it just and we did something a little different with the groove on it, you know, and the band. I think my band just locked into some super cool groove on that, you know, the instrumentals, just portions of the tune.
Well, very cool. Tommy Castro, it's great to catch up with you. Another great release on Alligator Records. I know a lot of folks are looking forward to seeing you at the Castle Theater here this week. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, we love the old Castle Theater. We got a lot of friends in the neighborhood. You know, we've been coming through there for some time now, and we look forward to seeing everybody with some new songs to play. And, of course, we'll be playing everybody's favorite old ones of ours. And thanks a lot for having me on your show. Sure do appreciate it.
Tommy Castro talking with GLT's John Norton. He and his band, The Painkillers, play the Castle Theater in Bloomington Thursday night with Bloomington's Old Smoke opening. Hear songs from Castro's new CD as well as other new and legendary blues artists on GLT Blues Radio 24/7 at WGLT.org and weekends on 89.1 GLT. Discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Let us know what you think of the show. Post comments at Facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media, 89.1 FM GLT and WGLT.org.